Hey there, tax fans. Welcome to State Tax Talks with me, your host, Joe Tantillo. I'm a tax attorney at the Hodge and Russ Law Firm looking to explore the nuances of state and local tax law. Here on the show, our goal is to keep tax informative, simple, and fun. So if you're ready to talk tax, turn up the volume and dive into this episode of State Tax Talks. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo. Today, I am joined by an exceptional guest, Mr. Tim Noonan.
Hey, Joe. Glad to be here.
Tim, thanks for being here. As a bit of background for you listeners out there, Tim is a partner here at Hodge and Russ. He is the leader of our tax residency practice group. He's a graduate of the University of Buffalo Law School, licensed to practice law in both New York and Connecticut, and he has handled thousands of New York State residency audits throughout all levels of the court system, including winning a case in New York's highest court, the Court of Appeals, back in 2014 with the Gayed case. Tim authors a monthly column in State Tax Notes called Noonan's Notes and was a co-author of the 2018 edition of the New York State Residency and Allocation Audit Handbook. He's been recognized by numerous authorities with various awards for his prowess in tax law, including being named to the Best Lawyers in America list in 2022. So, Tim, again, thank you for being on the show. Very excited to have you here.
Awesome. Thanks. Great intro, Joe. Good start.
So we're diving into the topic of tax residency audits today, and specifically what a taxpayer can expect in a New York residency audit. So let's start at the very beginning and kind of nail down the basics here. What is a residency audit for those of our listeners who are not familiar with the concept?
Sure. It's kind of like an investigation by New York State into someone's residency status. You know, there's lots of high net worth, high income taxpayers who used to live in New York, who live in New York now, who want to move from New York. And when those folks tell New York that they've moved through the filing of a non-resident tax return, New York often has questions. And those questions are what we would typically expect to see in a residency audit. So it's just a tax audit that New York State does a lot of in the residency area.
And you say that they do a lot of these. How many would you say in a typical year are initiated?
You know, thousands. A couple years ago, there was a FOIL request that was filed, basically, you know, under New York's Freedom of Information Law. One of the questions was, you know, hey guys, how many of these things do you do? And it was, you know, 4,000 or 5,000.
Wow, that's a lot. And how does that compare to other states who have similar residency audit programs?
It kind of blows them out of the water. I mean, no one does this as sort of often and as well as New York State.
And is there a reason that New York is more active in these types of residency audits than other states?
I mean, I think it's just because, like, lots of people are moving. Like, it's an area, you have a lot of people who will move to Florida or something like that. But plus, what you also have going on is New York City obviously being an economic center. So you have lots of folks who live in Connecticut but work in New York City or Jersey and work in New York. So, you know, questions about how they're income is taxed between the two states come up all the time. So, you know, it being an economic center, I think, has led to that as well.
Right. So it's not just, you know, the typical conception that the taxpayer has that New York is just out to get them. It's more complex than that.
Yeah. And look, the combined state and city tax rate, if you look at New York State and New York City, is like over 14%. So, you know, there's lots of reasons why the New York tax, it's a lot of revenue, right? So New York is interested in making sure the taxpayers are paying the right amount of taxes when tax rates are that high. In other states, first, tax rates are lower in a lot of other states, which is why a lot of people move to other states, actually. So tax rates are lower, and then you don't have kind of the migration of people in and out in other states like you might have in New York. You know, California is another state that's actually getting more active in this area because they're similar. Super high tax rates and lots of people wanting to leave. So, you know, California is another state where we see a lot of this stuff.
Right. So I'm a taxpayer. You know, what are the odds that I'm going to get audited by New York State?
Well, you don't make any money, Joe. So really not, you're fine. Right. No, it is income based. Like New York isn't going to really audit any old taxpayer who decides to move. We usually find like if you're making, you know, more than $1 million and you're claiming a move, something like that, that's probably you're in the zone of being subject to one of these audits. It might be changing. You know, there's been a lot more activity, a lot more people moving. So maybe that threshold is going up. But if you're kind of in that income range and you have moves in or out of New York, you know, you're a candidate.
As a trend, are we seeing more audits right now, less? What have you noticed over the course of the last, you know, 12 to 18 months in terms of New York State tax department activity?
Well, I mean, there's going to be more audits, you know, because what we've seen in our practice over the past couple of years around COVID is people fleeing New York like never before. So we've been, you know, handled hundreds of situations where folks are moving and we've had to help them. Those are folks in the zone of income that I just talked about. So those, all those folks are going to get audited, or at least, you know, a very large percentage of them. So what we have seen though, so I guess the short answer is it's been about the same in terms of the flow of audits as it's been in the past, which is there's been a lot. The other thing we've seen though in the recent past is New York sort of coming after people right away. Like as soon as they file their taxes, getting a notice like, hey, it looks like you moved. What happened? Like coming to them, not with like a full on normal audit, but just with like a quick, you know, a quick information request. So that's generated a lot of audits as well. But I think what we'll expect to see is because so many tens of thousands of people moved in 2020 and then again in 2021, it's potentially an avalanche of audits that we'll see in response to all that.
So I'm a former New York resident, or I consider myself a former New York resident. I pack my bags, I go to Florida, I make $1 million a year, and all of a sudden I get one of these, you know, notices. I don't know what to think. How does this work? You know, what are the basic rules of what makes someone a resident?
Yeah, there's two. So there's two ways you can be a resident of New York. One is based on this concept called domicile. Domicile is where your permanent home is, your primary home is. It's subjective. It's you're balancing various factors between New York and Florida in this instance to decide which place is your primary home. You know what I mean? So like for guys like you and me, it's easy, right? We have one house and one job and very simple life. If we move to Florida, probably going to pack up our home, sell it, and buy a house in Florida. For a lot of our clients, they're going to keep a house in New York. They're going to have a house in Florida. They're going to be spending time in both places. Balancing that out is the domicile test. Which of those two places is your primary home? The other test is more black and white. And the other test, if you spend more than 183 days in New York and you have a place in New York, well, then you're a resident anyway. So that's sort of the typical day count test where you can also get taxed as a resident.
Right. So is the inverse true? If I move to Florida for 183 days and have a house there, I'm just a Florida resident and I'm totally safe?
No, that's the problem because you got the two tests, right? So, you know, certainly anyone moving to Florida, you have to pass the 183-day rule. But, you know, if someone's moving to Florida and they want to say Florida's become my primary home, you kind of shouldn't be that close to 183 days in the first place. So it's a common misconception that, hey, 6 months and a day and I'm good. 6 months and a day and you're good for purposes of the more mechanical test. And by the way, that's called statutory residency, that test. So the statutory residency test is the mechanical test. But if we're doing a Florida move, we don't really want to be that close to 183. We want to have that spread of days be a lot more heavily favored towards Florida.
Right. So the taxpayer needs to win and prove that their domicile is not in New York and that it is only not in New York, but also elsewhere, and they can't be statutory residents.
That's right.
They got to achieve both of those things to be in the clear.
Yep.
So how do you assess someone's domicile? How is it determined?
Yeah, it's like I said, it's subjective. So you're balancing a variety of different facts and factors. The tax department has historically looked at five factors. So the five factors, your housing is one, your business is another, how much time you're spending is the third, where your stuff is called the near and dear factor, that's the fourth, and then where your family is, that's the fifth. So those are the main sort of, you know, factors that the tax department is going to be looking at.
Right. And you already alluded to, you know, for the average taxpayer, it's pretty straightforward. Most people have one job, one house, their own personal items. And when they move, they really move. They get on a plane and they're done. But a lot of people who are, you know, typically more high net worth, have more complex situations, this balance becomes much more difficult, right? It becomes more of a juggling act. So let's talk about these factors a bit, keeping that in mind, you know, the home factor. For those out there who maybe have multiple homes, or maybe they have some homes they rent, some homes they own. What kind of things do they need to be keeping in mind at the most basic level when they want to make one of these moves?
Yeah, I mean, one of the main things that comes up here is sort of history, like sort of the historical significance of the place. So if someone's moving to Florida and they keep their big home, you know, in Westchester where the kids grew up and all the memories and all the stuff is there, like, that's a negative factor, right? You know, usually if you're moving from one place to another, look, you might not need to sell your place in New York in order to finance a place in Florida. So that's fine. Like, the law allows you to keep a place. But if it's the same place that has all this history and in sort of ties, not great, right? So not fatal if you keep it. You know, so a lot of times what we'll see there is like a downsize. Like, that's a good thing. Like, you downsize your home in New York to prove that, yeah, I'm still gonna have a place up in New York because I want to, you know, go there in the winter, or I'm sorry, when the summer, when it's too hot, or when there's a hurricane or something like that, but downsizing. So, you know, that sort of historical comparison, and sort of related to that, you know, size matters, right? So do you have a huge house in Florida and a teeny house in New York, or vice versa, right? Do you have a 6,000 square foot place in New York and a 1,200, you know, one bedroom condo in Florida, 1,200 square feet? That's not so great. So, you know, weighing sort of, you know, relative size, they'll look at that, relative history, and then cost, right? If you're saying, well, my heart's in Florida, that's my primary home, but I have a $10 million apartment on Park Avenue, and I bought a condo for 500 grand in Florida, you know, that's not great either, right? Because it's like, well, geez, you have all this value up in New York and not so much in Florida. So size, value, history, those are kind of the big things.
You know, it's something we hear all the time, and I got to bring it up. You know, can you not just put the house in New York in a trust or in an LLC, and then you don't really own it anymore, right? It's owned by the LLC or the trust. You're good.
Yeah, nobody cares. That type of stuff, who, you know, it matters, like, whose head's on the pillow, like, who's using it, whose stuff is there, like, whose name's on the deed? It's just not. Again, a lot of people think, oh, I don't have a place in New York. My cousin's sister's trust has a place. Well, who stays there every time? Well, me. That's your place. And, you know, that our stuff is not important.
Yeah. But Tim, how are they going to know that I actually stayed in the house?
Yeah, well, there's a question on the tax. Well, I say a couple things, Joe. So first, there's a question on the tax return. It says, did you or your spouse maintain living quarters in New York? Yes or no? I mean, we sometimes joke that question really is, would you like to be audited by New York? Yes or no, right? But no, I mean, so you got to answer that question. And, you know, it doesn't say, is your name on a deed or whatever? It says, do you maintain living quarters? So right there in New York State, the tax people are pretty serious about that question. And if you answer it no, they get kind of ticked off. But the other thing is, you're going to get audited, and we'll probably talk about this later, but they're going to say, hey, you know, prove to me where you were. Show me your cell phone bills and your flight records and yada, yada. And if they see you up in New York for, like, you know, a few months, where'd you stay? Oh, 123 Main Street. What's there? Oh, well, there's this home there that's owned by my cousin's sister's trust. Oh, really? So they're going to see that you're staying in a place. So they'll find out. Don't worry.
Right. So the takeaway for those listening is that you really can't trick the auditors. They have been doing this for a long time. The system is quite sophisticated. And the truth is, again, you're going to hear us say this a lot throughout the course of this. You know, for the most part, if you want to move, you really have to move, or you at least have to take legitimate steps towards breaking ties with New York and establishing ties in the new state of domicile. So let's move on to the business factor was another one you mentioned. What do taxpayers need to kind of keep in mind with respect to that? Is it just active business ties? Is it passive too? I mean, how concerned do I need to be if I just have a couple of investments that are tied to New York State companies?
Yeah, it's really like, are you engaged in an active business, right? Because again, this is a real kind of subjective kind of inquiry, and they're looking to ties and connections and whatnot to New York. On the business side, it's active ties. Are you still running a business up here? Are you involved in day-to-day activities? Of course, with COVID, you can run a business from anywhere. So if you're running the business remotely from Florida or from wherever you say you moved, that's a bad thing, right? So any sort of continued ties or connections with a business, are you taking a big salary from a business? Those types of things matter. If you're selling a business, you're retiring, you're sort of backing away, you're giving sort of control of the business to other people, that's better, right? So those are the things we're sort of looking for here when we're comparing business ties.
Right. So obviously performing services physically in the state is probably the worst case scenario if you're constantly flying back here. I can't imagine it's great if you have a business that has an office up here and you're, you know, using it from time to time. What about if I, you know, I don't come to New York, say I'm the CEO or the president of a company that is historically based in New York, but I don't actually come here. You know, do I need to worry about that from the business factor?
It's still probably a tie, you know, because if you're still involved and, you know, folks are calling you all the time when you're down in Florida, you're still, you know, tied to that business in some respect. Yeah. I mean, is it fatal? Is it, are you going to lose your case? No, but it's the kind of thing that, you know, we're trying to show a breaking of ties to New York. So something like that, again, not fatal, but it'd be a factor that would come up.
Right.
And, you know, look, one of the things we'd say is, hey, open an office in Florida, right? Get a couple people down there, sort of show some ties down there to say, hey, look, I moved. I still got, you know, some business going on up here. It's okay. It's America. You're still allowed to have a business in New York, you know, but show that, okay, I'm developing some sort of, you know, ties and connections down in my new home state as well.
And I would guess for most people that the benefit of actually changing their domicile and the potential tax savings, especially if they're in that top tax bracket, would be significantly greater than the expenses of opening a modest office in Florida.
Yep. It would pay for itself, basically. Yeah.
Let's talk about the time factor. So we already mentioned that, you know, just 6 months in the new state and I'm good is a myth. So if that's a myth, then, you know, kind of where do I need to be in order to put myself in a good position on this factor?
Yeah, I mean, look, we're trying to show this is your home, right? So, you know, spending time, you're saying, and if I have multiple homes, like which is my primary home? You know, so there's lots of ways we're getting at it right now. What are the different ways you can determine whether someone's home is a primary home, the size of the home, things like that. But look, where you're spending your time, if you're saying, oh, my primary home's in Florida, well, you probably are spending most of your time there, right? Or more time there than any of your other homes. So the time factor is super important in these cases, particularly when you have someone moving to Florida or somewhere far away. Right. Maybe we'll talk about in a minute the time factor when someone lives in Connecticut might be different because you can spend time in Connecticut and New York on the same day. Not so much if you're going to Florida or something like that. So, yeah, look, there's no hard and fast rule. You want to, you know, if you want to prove Florida is your home, you want to spend more time there than New York. That's easy. You know, the greater that gap is, the greater that ratio of time in the new state versus New York, kind of the better your case is going to be. I think we found that in these audits, that's the one factor that someone really can control and use in their favor. If they're spending, let's say, twice as much time in Florida than New York, you know, something like a 2-to-1 ratio, that's pretty awesome, right? That's, I mean, what's the New York tax guy going to say? Oh, we think New York is your home. I mean, come on, man. I spent twice as much time in Florida. What are you crazy? So, I mean, you can, you know, it's a powerful factor. So the better, you know, and look, it's a factor that, you know, someone might have a big, huge house in Westchester that they can't sell and they want to keep, fine. You'd spend a heck of a lot more time in Florida. That's the way to really control and give yourself, you know, a lot of control over winning your case.
Is it strictly quantitative analysis when it comes to the time factor? You know, what if I have less than a 2-to-1 ratio, but I spend Thanksgiving and Christmas in Florida?
Yeah, it's both, right? So the quantitative is, hey, try to spend as much time there, you know, 2-to-1 ratio, something like that. The qualitative for sure. Where are you spending those, you know, weekends, holidays, things like that? So sure, that'll definitely come into play as well.
And is it, you know, it's all done in balance, right? Like I can't simply say, you know, I spent more time in New York, but look, I spent every single holiday, anniversary, kid's birthday party in Florida, so I should win, right? Like they're going to look at it, you know, as a cumulative set of facts.
Yeah. And look, I've had cases where, you know, the taxpayer ended up spending more days in New York. They say, I moved to Florida, but I spent more days there. And it's on paper, it's like, oh man, that's terrible. But that doesn't mean you lose, right? Because in the case I'm talking about, the guy came back to New York a lot because he got sick and his doctors were up here. He had sort of like specialty doctors up here and he was here a lot for that. So sort of circumstances outside his control. So it's not fatal if you spend more time in the old state and not as much time in the new state, but you know, it's you said, it's a sort of holistic thing that's it's looked at, you know, along with everything else.
Right. And how does that tie into the ever important question that we already talked about with respect to home of how does New York know where I am? How do they know where I'm spending my time?
Yeah. I mean, the government knows where you are, man. I mean, like, we're all carrying around these cell phones, right? So cell phones are tracking you whether you like it or not. For most carriers, some carriers, T-Mobile is one example that, of course, we've seen that doesn't track your phone. But who has T-Mobile, right? You know, no, but like Verizon, AT&T, like, you know, they can get records of where you were anytime you made or received a call. Anytime you're using your phone, like that data is out there. And of course, then your credit cards, your flight records, your passport, like, you know, 20 years ago, you know, when I first started doing this, or, you know, 30, 40 years ago, when some of our older partners were doing this, like, it was tougher, right? People are using cash for everything. And, you know, it's hard to track people, but these days it's not hard. So it's real easy to see where someone is. And that's good. Like, in these cases, we bear the burden to prove our case, right? We're kind of guilty until we prove ourselves innocent. So the auditor is going to start the audit with, hey, you know, we think your guy spent 365 days in New York. Prove me wrong. So we're going to need that data anyway. And, you know, sort of a good thing now that data is out there.
Right. So it's an entirely welcome situation where we are monitored constantly. And like the one time where you're going to be like, this is great. Thank goodness for, you know, Big Brother.
Yeah. And you know, there's an app for that, right? You know, so there's apps out there that you can put on your phone that will track you for this purpose, right? So it seems silly, but, you know, the sort of tracking is a good thing in this case.
One final question with respect to time. What if I'm a taxpayer who is spending time, you know, in Florida, but I'm also spending time in other states? Maybe I have a place in Colorado. I'm spending time out there as well. That's got to count, right, towards this ratio?
Doesn't. You know, it gets a little tough. Like, we have to prove that, you know, one of the things we say is, you know, you got to leave New York and you got to land somewhere else. You got to land in your new state. So if that state is in Florida, you got to land there. So, you know, days in Colorado don't really count towards that, towards the landing, right? They're not days in New York. Great. That's fine. But they're not days in Florida either. So they don't actually count for purposes of this time factor. And that can be good or bad, right? If you go to Colorado in July, when you'd probably otherwise maybe be in New York, awesome. You go in the middle of February, not so great, because we're kind of stealing days from Florida. So we got to be careful there for sure.
So we've talked about home, we've talked about business, we've talked about time. Let's talk about near and dear, your stuff. What does that really mean? Who's defining near and dear? And what if I don't feel like moving anything just because I'm not a possessions person?
Yeah. I mean, really the first three factors are the biggies. Like, those are the ones where sort of a lot of the action is, that, you know, the near and dear factor is a little, I don't say it's tangential, but it's tougher, right? These tax guys aren't going to be rummaging through your garbage or going through your house looking at, where's your stuff? Where's your artwork? Where's your antiques? Like, that type of stuff. They're not really doing that. You know, they'll look at your insurance records to see if you have stuff insured in your New York house or your Florida house or something like that. But yeah, I mean, it's, did you move stuff, right? You know, did you move, you know, your most expensive piece of art, right? Your antiques, stuff that's of value, stuff that's not of value, but that's important. You know, your wedding albums, your golf trophies, your pictures of your kids, things like that. So it's kind of a little bit too personal sometimes, like these audits will get, but they're looking for that type of stuff. So if you're planning a move, like, move stuff, right? You don't have to move your bed and your dresser and your couch, but, like, you know, move some pictures, move some artwork. You know, in my desk, in my home office, I got a box of, like, all my kids' birth certificates and, you know, various records. Like, move that stuff. Like, so that, you know, show that stuff, you know, where's your home and your most important stuff. You want to move that stuff to your home. So it's that kind of stuff.
How about the family factor?
So the main sort of focus of the family factor is on your spouse and your minor kids. You know what I mean? So, like, if your kids are in school in New York, but you're saying, hey, I live in Texas. Like, really? How does that work? You know, so, you know, where your minor kids are, where your kids are in school, like, that's a huge factor, right? So not in every case, but in most cases, you know, if you got little kids, where they go to school is probably going to be your domicile, right? So spouse, similar, like, husbands and wives, like, you know, they're married, for richer, for poorer, whatever it is. Like, you're together, right? So where your spouse is, that's where your domicile is. So it's tough for husband to say, oh, I live in Florida, and wife to say, well, I live in New York. Like, that, usually husbands and wives have the same domicile. So that's kind of the main, you know, factor we'll see for the family factor. You know, you got older kids, grown kids, grandchildren, that comes up, right? Again, getting to these things being kind of personal, like that stuff's going to come up too, but you know, that's, they can't really hold that against you as much as they're going to hold against you where your minor kids and your spouse is.
Right. But if you have minor children and you keep them in school in New York State, you're probably in big trouble.
Probably in big trouble. Not always. Like, you know, there's always exceptions, right? Never say never. But these cases are very fact intensive, but it's definitely going to be a big factor.
So one of the things that we haven't talked about are the formalities, the other factor that are the items that most people, when they think that they're going to move, are the things they need to take care of. Your driver's license, your voter registration, you know. Why didn't we talk about them under the primary factors? Isn't that important? Don't I need to fill out that declaration of domicile and that's really going to put me over the edge?
Yeah, it's not really. You know what I mean? Like that's kind of the window dressing of these moves. Like, you know, yeah, register to vote, get a driver's license, do all that stuff. You know, you can Google domicile checklists probably and find all that stuff. But honestly, like nobody really cares. Like if you do all that stuff, the tax auditor is going to say, big deal. Anybody can register to vote in Florida, you know? If you don't, they might be like, hey, why the heck didn't you register to vote? Like, isn't that important to you or something? So, you know, you kind of got to do them, but, you know, it's just not where the rubber meets the road in these cases. So yeah, it's just, they're not that important.
Tim, thank you for that thought. Folks, we're going to take a pause here and circle back in part two of this episode where we'll continue our interview with Tim Noonan and our discussion of what to expect in a New York residency audit. Thanks for joining us for another episode of State Tax Talks. If you're interested in listening to more episodes, we're available on all platforms where podcasts can be found, including YouTube. If you enjoyed this episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo, please give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform. And if you're in need of a tax professional, you can contact the tax attorneys at Hodgson Russ. Go to www.hodgsonruss.com for more information. And until next time, I'm Joe Tantillo, and this is State Tax Talks. Catch you later, tax fans.